We all know the saying, the wheels of justice turn slowly.
I used to know a guy like you back in the day.
Mm-hmm.
His name was Clarence Thomas. He got his.
You don't have to call the boy Clarence Thomas. Shit, he ain't that way.
Is it the company's position that its non-defamatory statements cancel out its
such bad timing. We just got a new comforter.
Yeah, actually, about that, I kind of want to keep that comforter. I paid for it.
Oh my God, do I need to get a lawyer?
Welcome to Opening Arguments, a podcast that pairs a comedian with a real-life lawyer. This podcast is sponsored by the law offices of P. Andrew Torres, LLC, for entertainment purposes, is not intended as legal advice, and does not form an attorney-client relationship. Don't take legal advice from a podcast.
Hello and welcome to Opening Arguments. This is episode 623. I'm Thomas. That's Andrew Torres, Esquire, Harvard attorney, qualified person, just drawing the contrast. How are you doing, Andrew?
Just in case, right?
Yeah.
I'm fantastic, Thomas. How are you?
I am good. Still excited about this consequences possibility. I know it's a small thing to be excited about consequences, like any form of consequences, but I am.
I'm excited as well. And I think there are reasons to feel optimistic. There are reasons to feel like the national dialogue and landscape are changing. And we've said this from the very beginning. Once that change starts, that can snowball. So I share that sense of optimism. But then again, it's always easy to get me on team optimism.
Yeah, so. Yeah. It's always easy to get me on Team Negatron.
That's
true. I'm a little worried, but I remain optimistic. I think that I'm not ready to say, you know, Merrick Garland was right and doing a great job all along, but I am fully open to that being the eventual outcome of this. How do you feel about that?
That's such a great question, and I think I agree with you on that. I think subject to the constraints that we were given, in the running were Merrick Garland and Doug Jones, not in the running. Morgan Stringer, right? You, right? Like, I would have loved, if I were president, I would have made Morgan Stringer, you know, my attorney general, and I would have said, hey, I want you staying up 20 hours a day, and I don't want you to rest until, you know, the one-eyed man is brought to justice. The one-armed man, I guess I should say. And by that, I mean Donald Trump.
The tiny-handed man, yeah.
Yeah, the tiny-handed man is brought to justice. There we go. That was clearly not the operating instructions that were given to Merrick Garland. So within the constraints of what we've had, the question has then become, does he take the cases as they develop in front of him? Or, as people have alleged to varying degrees, is he Lawrence Lessig's chicken shit? Well, we're going to talk about somebody who's chicken shit on this. He's not chicken shit, right? Does he have his thumb on the scale for the higher you go up? Was he afraid to go after Trump? I don't think any of those things.
Well,
I don't think we have the reason to believe those things are true.
We've argued about this before, but I do worry that he might be too scared of going after Trump when he would have gone after any normal citizen that he's given. You know, that's the only thing I'm worried about. I'm not worried about him being corrupt or whatever. Yeah.
Yeah.
But, well, that's good. I mean, so still optimistic. I will say this, that press conference was pretty amazing. I liked that a lot and hope there are more things to come. All right. So much show. I know you wanted to make a little announcement before we get going about next week's show.
Next week, we have an unambiguous good news show from start to finish. So if you've got friends who they're sometimes along for the ride, but you know, sometimes it requires a little bit of a breather, we get that. We're going to talk about a fantastic decision. We're going to layer on top of that a really, really great interview that we did. If you ever wanted to bring folks back into the Opening Arguments fold, next Tuesday is going to be a great opportunity to do that.
No one's left the Opening Arguments fold. I've seen the fold numbers, Andrew.
That's true.
Fold numbers are good.
All right, good, good. But good news next week.
Love it.
Treason is treason.
So, what's the Trump news?
There's a lot of stuff that I want to cover. There's an area where I disagree with a prominent former FBI lawyer, and I hope that I'm wrong on that. But yeah, so here are the Trump updates. And I want to begin with a couple of legitimate Andrew was wrongs. then I want to defend myself against some charges that have been brought by listeners. But let's start off with breaking news today with respect to a motion by both Judicial Watch. Yes, that's the former Larry Klayman outfit that he was ousted from. And news organizations to unseal the affidavit supporting the search warrant. As of the time we went to broadcast, it looks like the resolution there is that that judge wants to see what a redacted version of that affidavit would look like before ruling.
Now, what's in that affidavit? Is that an FBI agent affianting? Or is it whoever their source might have been on, like, someone telling the authorities that there might be a weird situation going on in Trump's document basement?
It can be both. An affidavit in support of a search warrant can rely upon information that might not be admissible at trial, right? Like hearsay. You don't run it through the rules of evidence. It just has to be sufficient evidence to establish probable cause in the mind of the magistrate judge. But it will be signed by a single affiant, or if you have more than one, right, multiple affiants. And those will be the FBI agents that are working the case, that are handling the surveillance, that are doing the day-to-day stuff. So it will recount not only what they have seen, but if people have told them stuff, it will recount what they have told them. Obviously, I watched the coverage of that motions hearing today. And at that hearing, the Department of Justice said, this warrant lays out in detail, we are in, quote, the early stages of a significant investigation that is politically sensitive, that is incredibly important. It basically did two things. It said, this is kind of the playbook for our case against Trump, which is still in the early stages. That's how I read it between the lines. So look, we knew, it was not hard to decode from the face of the warrant itself, that the DOJ is considering filing charges against the former president. It's kind of nice to hear them admit that in open court. And I was surprised that if you had asked me to wager, I would have bet the wrong way. My wager would have been that the judge would have just flatly denied this request from the beginning. They would have said, nope, there is, you know, yeah, there's significant public interest, but public interest is outweighed by the need for prosecutors to build their case. So denied. And here what the judge said was, we want to see what you would propose to release in redacted form. And you know, that puts the DOJ in a tough spot. if they do a catch-22 style redaction, redact everything but the salutation and the signature, then
that's going to politically look like, oh, they did this based on nothing.
Yeah, well, and also that's going to push the judge to release an unredacted version.
Oh, I see.
So,
yeah,
on the other hand, if they're able to kind of cut a fine line and protect their witnesses, their confidential sources, that sort of thing, then the judge might say, well, okay, well, this looks pretty good, right? Like, you've done a good job on this, so congratulations, you lose. So it's a tough spot to put lawyers in. The off-the-cuff statement I made that I want to own up to, we didn't do a lot of follow-up on it, but I said Trump's lawyer would have a copy of that affidavit, and that's not true.
Oh, really? Okay.
Yeah.
They just get like the warrant.
They get the warrant. I was thinking about cases. Again, I want to take responsibility first and explain second, right? I was thinking about cases in which a search warrant is accompanied by an arrest warrant, which often happens. And in that case, when they have decided to arrest you, you will get the whole packet, right? When they bring the charges against you, yeah, now you get to know. But when the investigation is still open, when there are still witnesses that could be identified and coerced, for example, you know, it's not like that's not within the Donald Trump playbook, then in their discretion. Because remember, what you're entitled to know is you're entitled to know that a judge, a magistrate judge, found probable cause to believe there would be evidence or instrumentality of a crime here. You're not entitled to know all of the things that went into that magistrate judge's decision.
Right. Until you're actually charged.
Until you're charged. And then when you're charged,
have that whatever amendment right to like face your accuser kind of thing. Is that where that comes from?
Exactly right. Plus
Eighth Amendment? What is it?
Sixth Amendment. But
I look, my error bars of plus or minus three amendments is, I'll take
that's
it.
That's right.
can get That's Thomas' crazy. Second Every- chance bar exam can get within three amendments of the right amendment. Okay.
That's outstanding. T2.
Don't even try. It's impossible.
Yeah, I will not. Okay. It would also fall within your rights of discovery and particularly within the broader rights set forth in Brady versus Maryland to require the government to turn over all potentially exculpatory material. You would want to know, what did you tell the magistrate to find this evidence? Because are you still defending that kind of, is there an inconsistency? So there are lots of reasons that you would be entitled to get it once you have been formally charged. But I had said offhandedly that they have it now and they don't have it now and want to own up to that one. The second thing that I want to hold up to, that's a little bit, it's the acronym from SCI, which again, tried to do off the cuff in our bonus episode. That's not an excuse, but it is, SCI is sensitive compartmented information. And I believe I said segregated. So in any event, we got a fair amount of
emails.
Mostly gentle emails. I'm going to read this one from listener Paul, because I thought the best ones were the ones that explained kind of the importance of that compartmented portion of it. Classified, here's what Paul says. Classified is an umbrella term for anything that needs to be protected. Under that umbrella, there are many subsets. There is for official use only, for example, that pertains to things that need to be protected, but are not necessarily governed by a specific set of rules. This could be administrative things like the plan of the day, the names of crew members, etc. Going up the scale, you get to confidential, which is the lowest classification that is governed by fixed rules. Going up from there, you have secret, then top secret. Beyond each classification term, there can be additional qualifiers, like no foreign, N-O-F-O-R-N, which would mean it can't ever be released to foreign nationals. For example, NATO countries, right? So even our allies, you would say, all right, this is top secret and no foreign. Behind top secret, there can also be SCI, sensitive compartmented information, which is almost always followed by a letter. And I've seen other folks say code word, right? Letter or code word, designating the compartment that information was gathered under. And then the way to think about it is you need top secret to be able to access it, to have clearance, to be eligible. But then the question is, do you, despite being entitled to look at this kind of information, do you need access to this particular information?
Right.
And so when something is top secret and SCI, not everybody with a top secret clearance gets to see it. You have to have both the clearance and the need to know. The need to know is necessary to be then given access. So I've extempt a little bit from Paul's letter. I'll go back to his terms. So the classification authority has to balance the need to know with the protection of the information. At the same time, allowing people that could use the info access to it for their work. After your need to know is done, you are read out of the program and sworn to keep those secrets for life. There is no waiver for the lifetime commitment to secrecy. So I thought that was helpful to understand the hierarchy. And yeah, I biffed the name, so I gotta own up to that one. So.
But none of this is as serious as like recipe that was shared in an email to a friend on a server that wasn't necessarily the official server. Right? None of it is like that. Sensor. That's code word top double secret.
There you go.
That's emails.
That's code word toll house. Yeah. Here is one that is definitely not an Andrew was wrong. And I thought we had flagged it out in advance on the show. I'd even identified the piece in the Atlantic, which is called Not Even the President Can Declassify Nuclear Secrets. And a number of listeners wrote back and were like, hey, have you read this piece in the Atlantic? Not Even the President Can Declassify. Right. So I want to read to you the second to the last paragraph of that article, because this is what's wrong. Unambiguously, clearly wrong, bordering on nonsense. That's not to say I don't love the Atlantic. It is to say when you read it, you will see, other than the parenthetical reference to the Atomic Energy Acts of 1946 and 1954, zero citations, zero analysis, zero evidence, and it's just a mishmash of stuff that's not correct. So here's what the article says. There are certain materials that presidents cannot classify and declassify at will. One such category of materials is nuclear secrets. Anything related to the production or use of nuclear weapons and nuclear power is inherently classified, and Trump could utter whatever words he pleased, yet still be in possession of classified material. Where are nuclear warheads? What tricks have we developed to make sure they work? This information is born secret, no matter who produces it. The restrictions on documents of this type are incredibly tight. In the unlikely event that Trump came up with a new way to enrich uranium and scribbled on a cocktail napkin poolside at Mar-a-Lago, that napkin would instantly have become a classified document subject to various controls and procedures and possibly illegal for the former president to possess. None of that is true.
Wow.
So before we go any further, I just want to reinforce classification status is not relevant to the crimes that are listed in the search warrant, right? So this is a purely academic discussion that we're having right now, but I like purely academic discussions.
Well, I think this is important to emphasize because I don't think I gathered this until I listened to Cleanup yesterday. I'm not sure if maybe our recording was like too early and this hadn't been developed, but it seems as though, just to reiterate in case anyone else was like me and kind of missed this, it seems as though the way they're charging it, or sorry, I shouldn't say charging, the way they drew up the, you know, the warrant, it didn't rely on, it only used the statutes that don't rely on the documents being secret still or whatever classification they are. Is that correct?
That is exactly right. We mentioned on Cleanup, for example, that it did not cite 18 U.S.C. section 1924, which depends upon the information being classified. It also did not cite, there was only one criminal statute that relates to the Atomic Energy Acts, and that is 42 U.S.C. 2274, communication of restricted data. Now, put a pin in the words restricted data. But this is the criminal offense for people who violate the Atomic Energy Acts. And again, not listed in the search warrant.
But just to make clear then, that means even the nonsense excuse of, well, we have a standing policy that just whenever the president does it, it's not against the law.
Right.
Sorry, I just cracked myself up in real time because that really is. You might as well say that. Oh, you don't understand, everybody. We had a standing policy that anything I do is fine. Oh, that should clear it up. Yeah. But that excuse of like anytime he took anything at home in his dedicated work life, you know, because he is just burning the midnight oil, that Trump. He's just going over documents. He's got like a magnifying glass. You know, I imagine he's just
it's like my office. Yeah.
But that excuse of whenever he took it out, we had a standing policy, da da da, that has zero relevance now, right?
Absolutely zero relevance.
Even if it were true, even though it's obviously not and no one can produce that thing and obviously. But it's like, it's funny that their excuse isn't even in the ballpark of relevant.
Correct. So let's look at, for example, the Espionage Act provision that is mentioned in the search warrant and that we talked about and that I think, you know, right now forms kind of the nucleus of what you would want to charge the former president of the United States with. It says, whoever having unauthorized possession of, access to, or control over any document, and then there's 15 different synonyms for document, relating to the national defense, or information relating to the national defense, which information the possessor has reason to believe could be used to the injury of the United States or to the advantage of any foreign nation, willfully, and then communicates, delivers, transmits, or attempts to do so to any person not entitled to receive it, or willfully retains the same and fails to deliver it to the officer or employee of the United States entitled to receive it. That's the predicate offense, is guilty of espionage and subject to a fine or to be imprisoned for more than 10 years or not more than 10 years or both. So notice that the operative phrase there is relating to the national defense.
Yeah.
So a document relates to the national defense, whether it's classified or not. The classification status, not relevant. So all of this is really an academic question as to whether the president can declassify nuclear secrets. And let me add at the outset, because none of those things are charged. He's not charged with violating 42 U.S.C. 2274. It's not listed in the search warrant. Let me also add that there is another sense in which this argument is trivially true, right? Hmm. And that is the sense of that as you just pointed out, and as I emphasized on our bonus episode, it's clear he hasn't done this, right?
Yeah. Like,
when they say, he declassified all of the stuff that he just happened to take, there are procedural requirements. We mentioned those. I actually did not mention the most recent, a minor Andrew was wrong. I did not mention the most recent executive order, which is EO 13526. Those are the up-to-date regulations for how classified material gets declassified, right? And it says information shall be declassified or downgraded by the official who authorized the original classification, if he's still serving in the same position and has the same classification authority, their successor in function, if they have the authority, a supervisory official, if they have the authority, or officials delegated declassification authority in writing by the agency head or senior agency official of the originating agency. So look, none of that procedure specifically says, hey, Trump can just kind of wave his hand and declare something declassified.
There's no, I didn't hear any language of like, it's also fine as long as you all just agree that it happened verbally in some unnamed date retroactively.
Right.
That's not,
right.
That's not in the language of the law. Okay.
So if you're trying to prove, if you're using the Atomic Energy Act to prove that the president didn't do what those regs say, right? And those regulations are 10 CFR, that's the Code of Federal Regulations, Part 1045. And yeah, that requires that the various levels of, and this is a subset of classification, right? And this is that term restricted data, and I'll define what it means. But basically, atomic energy, nuclear secrets, have their own set of classifications, and they're broken up into what the Department of Energy calls categories. And the decision to move things among the categories is handled procedurally in a different way than declassifying just garden variety classified information. It's handled by either a joint agreement between the Department of Energy and the Department of Defense, or a joint agreement between the Department of Energy and the Director of National Intelligence. But the importance of all of that is it's all executive branch agencies that are making all of those decisions. And so the question comes, what happens if the president takes a confidential document into a meeting with a foreign national? And as they are walking into the meeting, the White House counsel says, Mr. President, that's a classified document. It says no foreign audit.
Oh, I thought you were going to do the, like, they turn the corner, they bump into each other, the folder flies, all the documents.
Oh, where do they bury the survivors?
I got my documents, you got your documents, kind of thing, like with the foreign official.
No, I was going to say, what happens if the president short-circuits the procedures?
Ah.
And the answer with declassification of documents is, I can't say the president does this all the time. The president does this a lot. And in kind of the scenario that I've described, right? Like you have a sensitive meeting with Angela Merkel and you want to show her a document and the document says no foreign on the top. Well, you know, all right, the president is just like, all right, I hereby declassify this document for the purposes of doing X. That's not a crime.
Yeah.
Yeah, exactly.
And you're saying that could even be by just like implication, like if he just did it, you'd just be like, eh. Or is it just a matter of like, well, we're not going to charge that. That's silly.
That's exactly. There are zero cases about implication. And the reason is, the case that I relied on in that episode, Department of the Navy versus Egan, that was that 1988 case that says the president is the commander in chief and all decisions bearing on national security and to determine whether an individual is sufficiently trustworthy to have access to such information rest in the discretion flow from the constitutional investment of power in the president and quite apart from any explicit congressional grant. That's really, really strong language that says classified information is the kind of thing that is left to the discretion of the president under Article 2, and for which separation of powers would say Congress can't pass laws that would constrain the president's ability to do that, right?
That's pretty persuasive to me.
And I'm going to get into the specific application of that in a minute. We do not have examples of presidents just kind of willy-nilly taking documents that are nuclear secrets and pushing them down the line. But That's because we haven't had a president who was a Russian asset before, right? So it is, under the Atomic Energy Act, restricted data is defined as all data concerning design, manufacture, or utilization of atomic weapons. Love that archaic language. Production of special nuclear material and or use of special nuclear material in the production of energy. So that's RD. It's defined that way. It can become FRD, formerly restricted data. That's still classified information, but it has been removed from the RD category after the joint meeting between the DOE and the DOD. And by the way, if they disagree, the president gets to cast the tie-breaking vote. So again, at every level here, you see a ton of discretion invested in the president. And they must determine that that information relates to the military use of atomic weapons and can be adequately safeguarded through the ordinary national security information process. The step down from FRD is transclassified foreign nuclear information. It gets removed from the RD category after a joint determination from the DOE and the Director of National Intelligence that it concerns the atomic energy programs of other nations and can be protected like national security information. So that's how the atomic energy process works. Yes, it requires all of this procedural stuff that obviously didn't happen here. But the question is, what would happen if the president declassified nuclear secrets without going through the process? Would that be a crime, as The Atlantic suggests? Would that be impossible? Could you get a court judgment? And again, I go back to the Egan case, right? The Egan case, I read you the justification, right? This is a core Article 2 power over national security information, and it's independent of any grant from Congress. That case was about giving someone a security clearance, right? A guy named Tom Egan. And the question was, and so he had prior problems with alcohol. He had two gun convictions, assault convictions, and that he listed on his application, but left off two other ones and was like, well, I didn't think I needed to do that. And so he was hired as a civilian contractor to the Navy to work on repairing Trident submarines. And so during the interim period, like, he was not allowed access to the submarines. Then all of a sudden, you know, the Navy was like, yeah, upon review of your file, we are not giving you a security clearance. So we're going to fire you because, you know, you can't be on board the thing we hired you to fix. Now, if you are a member of the civil service generally, right, if you are a civilian contractor to the U.S. government, you have the right to appeal to the Merit Systems Protection Board, which is an independent board that reviews your termination and says that a government agency may only fire you only for such cause as will promote the efficiency of the service, end of quote. In other words, you have to be fired because you suck at your job, not for other reasons. Mm-hmm. And the question in this case was, did the Merit Systems Protection Board have the authority to look at this case at all? Mm. And the Supreme Court said no, notwithstanding the fact that this was a law created by Congress, that the determination of the classification of nuclear information what rests entirely in the executive branch, right. So I'll break down some of the detailed discussion. For reasons too obvious to call for enlarged discussion, the protection of classified information must be committed to the broad discretion of the executive agency responsible, and this must include the broad discretion to determine who may have access to it. As noted above, this must be a judgment call. The court has recognized the generally accepted view that foreign policy was the province and responsibility of the executive. As to these areas of Article II duties, the courts have traditionally shown the utmost deference to presidential responsibilities. So, yeah, notwithstanding the fact that Congress created this general law that says you have the right to an appeal to the Merit Systems Protection Board if you get fired because you can't have clearance, you don't get that, because we don't want anybody, even a congressionally authorized separate agency, to then second guess how here in this case, the Navy made their classification decisions. And we don't want to second guess that because that power flows from the president. So to me, that's as much of a, like, that's as case closed as you get. And I think if a president were charged, I think one of the reasons that it's not listed, 42 USC 2274, I think if a president were charged with violating that he would have a very good argument that he's immune from prosecution under that statute. In the same way that we talked about that He would have a very good argument that the provision of 1924 that says you can't run for office again doesn't apply to him, which, you know, we went through. So that's the last I'm going to say on the Atlanta. You want to take a different view? Feel free to take a different view. It obviously has never been litigated before.
Andrew, I read this Atlantic article, though, that disagrees with you. So could you address that?
Yeah.
Thanks. No, that's, we'll consider that case closed on
case
that.
Case closed.
Unless something develops. But so then we really shouldn't worry about that component of this, especially because it looks like they're not going to pursue that for exactly probably this reason, right? They're not going to worry about that. It's just all the other stuff, like, you know, having documents related to defense in a very precarious, unsafe place and all that stuff. So
yeah, it's a much better, like, our system is way better than that. It says, yeah, we don't care what label got stuck on this. If you have things that could benefit our geostrategic enemies, that's espionage. And that's a much better system. We don't have to figure this out. But it does, you know, gnaw at me to see what I think of as a pretty major misconception in print, and I wanted to address it.
This episode is brought to you by The Jordan Harbinger Show, which combines in-depth interviews with some of the world's most fascinating minds with Feedback Friday episodes to respond to listener questions about everything from conventional conundrums, like asking for a raise at work, to doozies like helping a family member escape a cult. I still have to recommend his recent episode with Dallas Taylor, host of one of my favorite podcasts, 20,000 Hertz. I am biased because I am an audio person, so that's what I like. That's what I'm going to recommend. Check that one out. And whether Jordan is conducting an interview or giving advice to a listener, you'll find something useful that you can apply to your own life in every single episode of The Jordan Harbinger Show. That could mean learning how to ask for advice the right way, or it could just be discovering a slight mindset tweak that changes how you see the world. Search for The Jordan Harbinger Show, that's H-A-R-B as in boy, I-N as in Nancy, G-E-R, in Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you're listening now. This show is brought to you by ClickUp. Imagine having one extra day every week. More time to cook healthy meals, work on that novel, or just binge some really good TV. Oh, I would love that. So many books. I have a lot of books that I need to catch up on. I would love one additional day. Imagine one additional day a week. Just read. That'd be great. Well, now it's possible with ClickUp, the productivity platform that'll save you one day a week on work guaranteed. ClickUp began with the premise that productivity was broken. There are too many tools to keep track of, too many things in entirely separate ecosystems. There has to be a more productive way to get through the daily hustle. Well, ClickUp is the one tool to house all your tasks, projects, docs, goals, spreadsheets, and more. ClickUp is built for teams from 1 to 1,000 plus. It's packed with features and customization options that no other productivity tool has, so you can work the way you work best. Whether you're in project management, engineering, sales, marketing, or HR, ClickUp has easy-to-use solutions that create a more efficient work environment. Join the more than 800,000 highly productive teams using ClickUp today. Use code OPENING to get 15% off ClickUp's massive unlimited plan for a year, meaning you can start reclaiming your time for under $5 a month. Sign up today at ClickUp.com and use code OPENING. Hurry, this offer ends soon. This show is brought to you by Mint Mobile. After years of fine print contracts and getting ripped off by big wireless providers, if we've learned anything, it's that there's always a catch. This is so true. Everything I've ever signed up for promises so much for like one rate, and then you read the fine print and then it's actually, oh no, if you actually use more than 3 megabytes of data, then you actually pay $100 more. Some nonsense like that. So when I first heard that Mint Mobile offers premium wireless starting at just $15 a month, I was looking for that catch. But after talking to them and using their service, it all made sense. There isn't a catch. Mint Mobile's secret is that they're the first company to sell wireless service online only. They cut out the cost of retail stores and pass those sweet savings directly to you. And the service is great. It's exactly the same as my previous provider. But you know what's not the same? The bill, baby. The bill is so much lower. So there was no drop in performance, but there was a massive drop in the amount I was paying each month, because now I'm paying $15 a month. And Mint Mobile gives you the best rate whether you're buying for one or for a family. And at Mint, families start at 2 lines. All plans come with unlimited talk and text, plus high-speed data delivered on the nation's largest 5G network. Use your own phone with any Mint Mobile plan and keep your same phone number along with all your existing contacts. Switch to Mint Mobile and get premium wireless service starting at just $15 a month. I did it. I switched my existing phone. It was super easy. The process was really cool, and it's done. So to get your new wireless plan for just $15 a month and to get the plan shipped to your door for free, go to mintmobile.com/opening. That's mintmobile.com/opening. Cut your wireless bill to $15 a month at mintmobile.com/opening. Now on to the breaking news on Weisselberg. We haven't talked as much on this. I feel like this has been more of a cleanup topic. And it seems as though, and slash a Twitter topic, by the way, if you follow OpenArgs on Twitter, it seems like this was kind of a disappointing thing to you, or something was amiss here. Why don't you clarify what happened with Alan Weisselberg?
Yeah, this is a massive miss for me. This is the Manhattan District Attorney's investigation into the Trump org. You might recall, we talked about it on this show at the end of the year 2021, because Cy Vance was leaving on January 1st, 2022, which he did. And he was supposed to make a decision up or down before leaving. That didn't happen. It got passed on to his successor, Alvin Bragg. And we went through all the reasons why a Democratic prosecutor would probably want the opportunity to bring a case against Donald Trump. And then there were rumors that this was sort of being left for dead. And in my view, this deal absolutely 100% confirms that Alvin Bragg is one of Lawrence Lessig's chicken shit prosecutors. And here's why. Alan Weisselberg is the CFO of the Trump Organization. He is the guy who literally knows where the bodies are buried. He has signed off on or countersigned opposite that stupid Trump signature with his Sharpie on every major fraudulent decision that Donald Trump made pre-presidency, right? So that included the like crazy deal in Florida where he had Mar-a-Lago buy a picture of himself to satisfy an outstanding deal with the local officials in Palm Springs. I mean, it's just nonsense, right? This guy has been a close Trump confidant, and that means willing to lie to protect Donald Trump for as long as Donald Trump has been around. So, and he's 75. And the idea was to squeeze him, right? Let's see if he'll flip. And so Vance, again, somebody who's subject to a significant amount of criticism on the left as being not particularly diligent in going after folks like Trump, Vance set up a pretty good set of 15 counts against Weisselberg that are knockdown charges for tax evasion. And they extended, you remember when this came out, it extends to Weisselberg got rent-free Manhattan apartment, never declared and paid taxes on that. He got his kids and his grandkids into private schools. All totaled, it amounted to avoiding $1.87 million in taxes, right? So the benefits were way larger than that. And the idea was, okay, so you've been super loyal to Trump, but this is going to be 15 years in jail, man. And maybe you'd like to flip right now.
Yeah.
And then things went silent. And then the deal, and I have read the plea agreement. The plea agreement involves pleading guilty to those 15 charges in exchange for 5 months in prison. With time served, news outlets are reporting that as 100 days. And Rikers Island, so I had said previously, I think, you know, country club prison. Rikers is not a country club, so fair enough. He does have to go to Rikers for 3 months and a week. The biggest thing is it does not contain a cooperation agreement as part of the plea deal. In other words, he does not have to and
will not cooperate
with the prosecutors. What it requires him to do is testify at the October 24th trial against the Trump org. And some folks, including folks I really, really respect, right? Andrew Weissman, you know, former chief counsel over at the FBI, super smart guy on our side. I respect him. I think he's looking for a reason to read this optimistically. And I'll give you what I think is the best steel-botting of his position in a minute. But I want to get out the negatron part first. And that is, requiring somebody to testify who is a serial liar is almost no requirement at all. And so folks have, well, you know, you could try him for perjury. And it's like, this DA didn't want to try him for 15 knockdown, super easy. Anybody, you could try this case, Thomas.
Oh, I can? Awesome.
I wish you would. I'll get on it. If you weren't going
briefcase
to take him,
spills open, jelly beans fall out.
Right, yeah. But if you weren't going to take Weisselberg to trial over 15 heavily documented tax fraud crimes, you're not going to take him to trial over perjury, right? This is a guy who's been lying for 75 years. He knows how to couch the lie, right? Like, he's just going to say, they're going to say, like, if they ask him any Trump questions at all, which, by the way, they may not. This is a trial solely of the Trump org, and the highest ranking non-Trump member, the highest ranking day-to-day person at Trump org is Alan Weisselberg. So, yeah. You know, what he'll testify is, yes, I, at the Trump Organization, conspired with the Trump Organization to make sure that I got an apartment rent-free. Did anybody else assist you in that? Well, not really that I can recall. What about Donald Trump? No, I
dude doesn't even know what goes on here.
Yeah, he's kind of checked out. I mean, I feel bad about that, right? Like, how the hell are you going to prove? Yeah, I don't know. I think he knew later on that maybe I had my hands in the cookie jar, but I think that probably disappointed him, and I'm ashamed of that, but he probably let it go in light of my years of service. I'm making that off the top of my head. The excuses you can give for giving a dishonest answer when you're not backstopped by a cooperation agreement are almost infinite. And it is virtually impossible to prove that that's perjury. How are you going to prove that Alan Weisselberg didn't think that Donald Trump was disappointed in him or didn't? Oh yeah, you showed me. Okay, you're right. I hadn't recalled that when you asked me that question the first time around. You're right. Okay.
Yeah. In all of this, we've talked about perjury a lot, and it just seems like it's kind of a zero every time.
Yeah, that's what I've been saying to people on Twitter is, okay, show me perjury prosecutions, show me perjury convictions, you know, from the past 10 years. You can't find them, right?
Oh, but I was just going to ask you, in all of this Trump stuff and everything, January 6th even, off the top of your head, has anyone been successfully charged and found guilty of perjury in this?
Not that I know of.
The liars and all the everything, that's a pretty convincing argument to me.
Yeah, and on the other hand, when you put cooperation in the agreement, that's super easy to have, right? Like, because that's at the subjective control of the Department of Justice. And they just have to say, oh yeah, this guy's been cooperating versus, oh yeah, no, this guy, the second he signed that deal, stopped cooperating with us and fed us misinformation. And so we're blowing up his deal. And you see that happen all the time. That's what happened with Paul Manafort, right? Remember, like, way back at the beginning, you know, people thought, oh yeah, Paul Manafort signed a deal. Well, the reason they took him to trial was because his deal required cooperation. He obviously didn't cooperate. And they're like, well, congratulations, you've lost your deal. And to me, omitting a cooperation agreement is such a red flag that anything else to the contrary, it just pales by comparison. Now, Weissman's argument, and I know, Andrew Weissman, Alan Weisselberg, we got to keep it. Right. Weissman's argument is that it is significant that the plea agreement does not contain a complete coverage charge.
By the way, before we go into this, can I just make sure we didn't really frame the basics of this argument? Is the very broad strokes, you're saying this sucks and someone else is the dog in the room on fire saying this is fine? Is that kind of...
No, it's stronger than that. Weissman has said this is bad for Trump, and this means that Weisselberg is going to go and testify about all the crimes that the Trump org committed and will testify truthfully, and it will be virtually impossible for him to give testimony that does not also implicate Donald Trump. That is, I watched
so someone
him on
is
MSNBC.
Optimus priming you. You're the Negatron here.
Yes, that's right. I am the Negatron in this.
I think it's important to note that that's not just an act. Like, this is, you know, you're like, you genuinely, you go where you think the evidence is, and this is, you're Negatroning this one.
Yes, that's right. And I will tell you, Weissman's piece of evidence, and it must be credited as a ledger on his side, is that the deal does not contain a complete coverage clause. Now, you see that a lot, where when you agree to a plea deal, it says the government agrees not to prosecute you for the crimes listed, you know, the 15 crimes to which you're pleading, and also, you know, any related crime, you know, blah, 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 would give you some protection against being reindicted for a similar, a related offense that is not covered by the deal. He's right that it doesn't have that in there. He's right that the lawyers for Weisselberg would have asked for that. My explanation is really, really simple, that was the, you know, Saul Goodman step too far, right? Like, I don't want to give spoilers for the finale of Better Call Saul, but, you know, if you've seen it, you'll get the reference. And that, you know, Alvin Bragg said, no, man, you're not giving us cooperation. We're not going to give you complete coverage. That's it. Take it or leave it. And they went back and were like, 3 months and a week? Yeah, we'll take it. My argument here is, if there was absolutely any reason that you had any desire to go after Donald Trump, you would take Weisselberg to court rather than settle for 5 months, right? You got 15 well-documented, absolute knockdown charges that show tax evasion and fraud. And, you know, you have the potential to get a guy for 15 years. Fine. You hit on a couple and you get 3 years. That is way better. You lose, like, it's almost the same as this, right? Because he's at least got to be, you know, he's got to stand trial. There was no visible upside other than, in my view, the DA's office says, okay, well, if we're not going after Trump anymore, because this guy's not going to flip, then why am I going to squeeze and go to a trial and, like, put my time and effort into securing a conviction of a guy who's 75? And we know what happened here, right? Like, that he's the instrumentality by which Trump fraudulently ran the Trump org. And, you know, if you're not interested in going after the king, what do you care about this guy? That's my view of it. I could be wrong. I would like to be wrong. I would like this to be some kind of, you know, crazy triple Xanatos gambit. It doesn't seem. The most parsimonious explanation to me seems to be there's no appetite at the Manhattan DA for taking on Trump in connection with real estate. And some of that may be, yeah, well, let's let Fannie Willis in Georgia indict Trump on those state crimes. Let's let Merrick Garland indict him on federal crimes. This isn't the best case. I don't know, right?
Well, is this still the same office where the two guys, like, resigned and were like, this thing sucks?
Yes, that's exactly right.
So it sounds like this thing sucks.
It feels like, and again, remember, the case is against the Trump org in connection with real estate fraud. Now, that parallel case, the civil investigation, we know is being pursued diligently. But at the end of the day, right, there are only civil consequences. There are only damages that are going to be extracted in that case. Could somebody from the Trump org go to they could, but I don't think that's going to happen. I think you're going to get an adjudication. You're going to get a fine against the Trump org. Maybe it will be dissolved. Who the hell cares? It's a family-held LLC. This is not like dissolving the National Rifle Association, right? Like, Eric Trump and Ivanka can start the EI Trump org. You know, who cares? I do not see justice for the former president of the United States coming out of these developments. I'm pretty negatron-y on it.
Is it just that Weisselberg, you know, he's a million years old, has made his millions from this scam, doesn't particularly want to turn on Trump, and the consequences for what he's done aren't bad enough to force him to do that? Is that what's going on?
If, and this is 100% speculation, and I am not a criminal lawyer, so place this in the asterisky of asterisky categories, I suspect that Weisselberg looked at Alvin Bragg, Manhattan DA Alvin Bragg, and said, I really don't want to do 15 years in jail, but I'm going to do 15 years in jail before I would flip on Donald Trump. You do with that what you will. That's what I believe he said. I think that would be consistent with the kind of game of chicken we've had for the past 6 months, with the unbelievable sweetheart deal that's come out of it. And I think it explains the lack of cooperation. If a witness has told you, I'm going to lie to you, then you don't want their cooperation. And I think that explains all of it. But I am open to other interpretations, but so far I have not heard a better, more plausible explanation than that.
Yeah. Darn. That doesn't sound great.
No, it's not great. Look, lots of great news in this episode. So, you know, that's a not great, but yeah. I feel like we need to be honest about it.
Will we ever know? I know we got a lot of other stuff to talk about still, and the episode is growing long in the tooth. But will we ever know what happened here? I mean, with that whole prosecutors resigning and all that stuff, I mean, will we ever know for sure? Because it's kind of like if you don't prosecute, then you don't really, unless Hillary is the person in question, you don't do a press conference telling everybody why you didn't prosecute.
Yeah, prosecutorial discretion covers a lot of sins. I don't know that we will ever know. And, you know, it falls into that bucket. You know, we talked about the inverse of the Nixon question. I get the feeling, and I think it is a justified feeling, that a lot of people, particularly a lot of people, you know, in their 30s and younger have of, it doesn't matter political party, it doesn't matter offense, rich, powerful, white, politically connected folks never, ever pay the price, are never held accountable. They don't think that's true, but I get why you feel that way. And this certainly doesn't help. In my view.
Yeah, I guess maybe technically not never, but feels like close to that.
I get that feeling. I do. I really do.
Let's talk about the passport thing. This was a quick thing. It was a tweet that was so weird that I thought it might be fake. Or not a tweet, a truth, you know. But they seized Trump's passports and everyone made a big deal about like, oh, that's a big deal. I don't want him to be able to flee. I don't think we have time to talk about the, like, you know, the fact that he had two or three of them. I don't think that turns out, yeah, that's pretty normal. Doesn't matter is the answer to that. But now we've heard they've returned his passport. So what would that have all been about?
The Trump truth, I don't know what the verb is for his little nonsense platform was. In the raid of the FBI of Mar-a-Lago, they stole my three passports along with everything else. This is an assault on a political opponent at a level never before seen in our country. Third world, which we had to get in a little, like, you know, racist remark at the end as well. I love that. And then as it completely turns out, the
Jay we see Brett, another truth that's like, yeah. Oh, never mind. They were in this box of nuclear secrets. I accidentally left them there.
Yeah. This happens all the time when law enforcement executes a search warrant. This is why, right? They give you the receipt of the stuff they've taken as they're taking it out. But then they're going through in detail and they're like, oh, man, yeah, okay. Maybe we shouldn't have taken that, right? And they higher likelihood, if you are a rich white defendant, they'll return the stuff that they shouldn't have taken to you, right? And so because of the nuclear secrets that were present, the execution of the search warrant was attended by Jay Bratt, who was the chief of the counterintelligence and export control section at the National Security Division, wrote an email and said, with the subject line, passports, and says, oh, hey, we are returning them. They will be ready for pickup at 2 p.m. today.
So that's an all big nothing.
It was an absolute nothing. So a nothing on both sides. Like, those of us on the left were like, hey, if they've seized his passports, yeah, that means he's a flight risk. And, you know, whatever. And then
that
would have
been
right,
nice if it was that reason and that, yeah, serious. But no, alas.
Usually, I mean, the key hint on that is usually you would have a separate court order that orders the seizure of passports. That should have been the clue to those of us who were excited about it on Monday that maybe this was not a court order. Maybe this was a mistake. But also this is the worst. They're planting evidence, which I want back. And yeah, right. Trump has his passports back. He has confirmed that he's gotten them back. And this was never a story. Don't let Uncle Frank tell you it was.
Final bullet point, Liz Cheney. This is, I don't know how to feel about this. I mean, I guess bad. She lost her primary by a lot because she went up against Trump. And I don't really think that's good that she lost.
Yeah, I agree with that. I have said, you know, I think that this represented actual political courage. And, you know, folks have sometimes pushed back on that. I think that the significant thing here is the number, right? She lost by 30 points, yeah, to an idiot after winning with 75% of the vote 2 years ago. And, you know, Liz Cheney herself released a statement. She was like, I won with 73% last time. I could have won with 73% this time. All I had to do, all I would have had to have done is what Kevin McCarthy did. Not even come out and be, you know, she didn't say come out and be, you know, a Lauren Boebert, a Marjorie Taylor Greene. No. But all I would have had to have done is not confronted the president of the United States, the former president of the United States, on the fact that he's lying about the election. And if I hadn't done that, I would have coasted to re-election. She's 100% right.
Yeah.
So whatever you think, that was a real political cost. We've gotten a couple questions as a result of her loss that I want to cover. Number one, she remains a member of Congress until January 2nd, 2023. So she will not depart from the January 6th committee. She will not depart from the Congress. She's got work to do. And assuming that Republicans do not take the House, if they do, they will disband the January 6th committee, right? They will begin investigations into impeaching Merrick Garland and Joe Biden, and it will be a nightmare. So if, you know, again, you're not fully sold on, you know, your local Democratic House candidate, that's what's coming if you decide to vote for the Green Party candidate in your district or stay home. Get out there and vote for your Democratic representative, because the numbers are real bad right now. We're hoping to turn them around, but if the Democrats lose the House, Republicans will disband the 1-6 committee and begin sham investigations. And impeachment. If that does not happen, if we somehow manage to hold on to the House, then the January 6th committee can hire Liz Cheney as counsel. She's a lawyer. So absolutely, I hope they do that. And, you know, we have seen some of the video testimony of some of the lawyers working for the 1-6 committee. So, yeah, I just wanted to answer kind of that question. The two questions I got were, does this derail the January 6th committee? No, it does not. And can she still be involved? Yes, she still can. So there you go.
That's interesting. All right. Well, mixed bag. Some good, some bad. But overall, excited to keep on paying attention to the story and keep getting the good OA breakdowns.
Indeed.
Wild card!
What? And we don't really have time for a wild card, Andrew. But we love our audience so much, we'll do a wild card anyway. Wild card, woo! So, Alex Jones, what is our quick wild card update on that lizard person?
Yep. Alex Jones, jury selection continues today as we are recording, which means that the docket has been restricted. So fortunately, the dozen pleadings that I pulled down last night, I was able to get my hands on. And I want to update you in this way, right? So the judge, no nonsense, is not monkeying around, not going to move the trial date. The case has been remanded back from bankruptcy court. I had an entire long discussion on core versus non-core and remand. And, you know, well, if you get the show notes, you can read all about that. But here's what you need to know. The bankruptcy ploy to stall this case failed. The court is having parallel proceedings of potential disciplinary proceedings against two of Alex Jones's lawyers, Norm Pattis, who is a regular InfoWars contributor and a psychopath, and McMullet, the lawyer from the Texas case, and Dino Reynal. And this is in connection with the bombshell moment in Texas where plaintiff's counsel revealed that they had given him...
I remember that.
Yeah, 2.5 years worth of Alex's
featured on our show a lot and was a segment bumper and all that.
Yeah, it was fantastic. And the court, the Connecticut court, was rightfully troubled that the one thing plaintiff's counsel deleted as soon as they saw it were in-depth medical psychological evaluations of the plaintiffs, the Sandy Hook plaintiffs in Connecticut, which in addition to being gross and illegal, to share them is a violation of HIPAA laws plus, you know, God knows what else. So the court, the second they found out about it, Judge Bellis, she entered two orders requiring that Norm Pattis and Andino Reynal show cause as to why they should not be referred to disciplinary authorities or sanctioned by the court directly in connection with the purported release of medical records by the plaintiffs. Norm Pattis moved to dismiss which is kind of a weird thing. I don't think that's the proper motion, but moved to dismiss that show cause order and also filed a motion to require Judge Bellis to recuse herself because, you know, she's such a meanie pants. Yesterday, the court issued orders with respect to both of those, which I have in my notes as...
Are they... Nah.
I have them in my notes as LOL. So, yeah, basically the same thing.
LOL, no. Yeah.
Yeah. That the first part was, you can't sanction us for stuff you don't see. I am not kidding. That was their argument, like the kind of Jurassic Park T-Rex theory of like, if we don't do the crime in front of you, judge, you can't sanction
like,
us.
Like as in the... Having the medical records or the what's
yeah,
the
like
thing?
They have to actually pass it in the court. Who knows, right? Like you have to catch them. And the court was like, "What are you talking about?" Like I know that you're taking the phrase like that it sanctions conduct occurring in the courthouse, right? But that means in the case that absolutely can occur when you email stuff at night that you're not supposed to have. The delightful part of that, and I have tweeted it out, we will link it in the show notes, is the Exhibit A to that motion to dismiss contains a lengthy affidavit from Kyung S. Lee, who is Alex Jones's counsel in the bankruptcy proceeding. He's the reason. He's the first domino in the comedy of errors that resulted in that hard drive, which it was a white separate hard drive. So
wait, sorry, what hard? I thought it was a phone.
The phone was downloaded to a hard drive, right? Because
again,
300 gigs worth of stuff. So Norm Pattis has a white hard drive, external hard drive, and Lee, the bankruptcy attorney, sends an email to Norm Pattis that says, hey, man, I'm trying to deal with this bankruptcy. Any evidence that you can give me that will help me understand this case would be really, really helpful. And Norm Pattis is like, sure, boy, do I have evidence for you, and sends off the entire hard drive. While the hard drive is in transit, the plaintiffs drop their case against the first set of InfoWars debtors that declared bankruptcy, because remember, it was a stunt. So they had these like minor companies that were named as part of the complaint go to bankruptcy. And so then the plaintiffs were like, okay, great. Well, we don't have any claims against these tiny companies that are now in bankruptcy. So we're done here. And so then as a result of that, Kim says, so I never looked at the drop. And then eventually I went down to Texas and I handed it over to Raynal. And I know that I handed it over to Raynal prior to June 15th, because on June 15th, Norm Pattis emailed me and said, hey man, can I get that drive back? And I said, oh yeah, I'm sorry. I gave it to the mullet dude down in Texas. So that's the beginning of the comedy of errors of Alex Jones's lawyers. Not Norm Pattis didn't bother looking at this thing. And maybe you should before you start sending it all around. So important part is...
Mistakes were made.
Yeah. Those sanctions proceedings will continue. They will be parallel next Thursday and Friday because, of course, they will be, because the court does not want us to be able to cover it on opening arguments. But it does not look good. If you want to know, are Pattis and Raynal facing a 20-piece bucket of trouble like appear to be?
Yeah, and just to clarify, they're not in trouble for just being really shitty lawyers for Alex Jones. That apparently is fine. you can be as bad as you want. It's just the sensitive materials.
It's the transmitting medical information. Right. Because you're an officer of the court. That's not a thing you should be doing as a lawyer.
All right. Well, a little wild card for you on Alex Jones, and can't wait for the next case. Going to be so fun. Lots of good news these days.
Indeed.
And even more on Tuesday.
And thank you.
And now it's time to thank our new patrons at patreon.com/law and join all the goodies, ad-free episodes, the early shows, the Q&A, the lot awful movies that should be coming at you real soon. Lots of stuff. Andrew, why don't you start us off?
Yeah, big thank you to Tyrell Prosser, Laura Morneau, Melanie, Elliot Nest, Molly S. Kirsch, Patrick, Jeffrey Waldmiller, Lachlan Donald, Janine Morphis, to pew, 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 finger guns are my Second Amendment right. They sure are. Tell a 3L how to find a job in government 9 to 5. Yeah, that's a great question. Show up at one of our Q&As because I could talk about that. SG, briefly, amici ugiorum. Hope I've said that correctly. I have no idea what that last Latin word means. So, Philip Holt, Zanzibar, Andrea Levine, Caleb Benningfield, Danny Cavalier, Netero H, Bree Koger, Flagrant System Error. I want to see Andrew play Phoenix Wright Ace Attorney. Yeah, I'll give that a shot. Lenior Simmons and Samuel Sachs. Thank you all so much. Take it away, Thomas.
And thank you to Lucian Blakemore, Josh Payne. I took legal advice from a podcast and all I got were these shiny silver bracelets. Rich Fancy Man, Lord Wilford Snibble Snibble of the Gribble Pibble, Chi Wizzle, Justin Brucky, Isaac, James Martin, Pulver, Sarah Wolf, greetings from a former Townsendite, JC, David Wince, literally, Caitlin Carlton, Travis J. Payson, Andrew Dodd, Ariana Muris, Patty B., Lisa Richter. I argued with Thomas in AP Gov prior to his progressive awakening. That's absolutely true.
Oh, wow.
I recognize the patron. Thank you for becoming a patron. Nice to see your name reflected there. And yeah, that's totally true. I was the worst, most awful conservative in high school, as I've said many a time. Raina, Matt Jenkins, and Jamie L. Frederick. Thank you so much, new patrons.
Oh, no associate of this firm has ever failed the bar exam.
No kidding.
And now it's time for T3BE. Thomas gets totally tricked by a trick question. That was fun last week. Boy, that really got me. Nice prank, Andrew.
Sorry.
Let's see if there's a not prank question this time, or maybe it will be.
Let's see how you feel about this question. Thomas, a man was taken to a police station for questioning after his girlfriend disappeared. The man was not given Miranda warnings. After a few minutes of questioning by a police officer, the man confessed to murdering his girlfriend and told the police officer that he threw the gun that he used to shoot his girlfriend in a swamp, which was then located several miles from the city. After an intensive search of the swamp over a period of several weeks, the police found the gun. The man is charged with first-degree murder. The prosecutor plans to use the gun as evidence against the man at trial.
Fruits of the poisonous tree, perhaps.
The man argues that the gun should be suppressed at trial. Will he prevail? Ooh. A, yes, because the man was not given Miranda warnings. B, yes, because the interrogation violated the man's due process rights. C, no, because the exclusionary rule will not serve to exclude the gun from evidence. Or D, no, pursuant to the inevitable discovery exception to the exclusionary rule.
Yeah, we were inevitably going to find this gun in this swamp. This is a tough one. So I think there's a little bit of blurry whatever in the, like, police just asking questions. Hey, man, I'm just asking questions. But taking them into the police station feels like enough to where you would need to Mirandize him. A few minutes of questioning. As all these questions are, it feels pretty close to me. Like, I'm pretty sure if a police officer is just on the street, you know, for whatever reason and sees you, or like you're on the scene and the officer's just like, hey, what do you know about this? What's going on? And then you're like, I did it. I killed Ned Johnson. I don't think they needed to Mirandize you for that. I think there's some blurry gray area. And that's why the, like, am I under arrest is actually a valid question, I think, because you need to clarify all that, I think. This feels, here's my problem. I think in terms of what's fair, if you are taken to a police station and questioned, you should be Mirandized. But like in terms of what this Supreme Court has said, or even a Supreme Court going back a few decades of just being really pro-police, I worry, but I think I'm going to go with what feels right. It feels like you needed to be Mirandized here. Okay, so confession without Miranda warning should go away. Told them where the gun was. Now, is that the fruit of the poisonous whatever? Is that the, you know? So he told him where the thing is, searched in the swamp. After intensive search, they found the gun. This is really tough. Okay, does the Miranda warning cancel all that out? They never would have known about the gun and all that. Or is it just going to be that you can't get his confession into the trial, but you still get the gun in there, even though it's going to be like, well, how did you find it? I can't say. I don't know. Will the gun be suppressed? A, yes, because the man was not given Miranda warnings. That's certainly plausible. B, yes, because the interrogation violated the man's due process rights. That's an interesting one because it's sort of like the same answer, but without Miranda. I think I like A over B if I'm doing a yes. I think Miranda's the issue. I'm not sure what other thing in the interrogation violated due process, really, if not, it's just Miranda, I think. So I'm going to go A over B, but let's check the no answers. C, no, because the exclusionary rule will not serve to exclude the gun from evidence. So that's a solid one. I can't remember if that's the right wording because I'm not a lawyer, but that would be along the lines of like, yeah, okay, we don't let the confession in, but like, come on, we found the gun kind of thing. We're not going to just like not have the murder weapon. Or D, no, pursuant to the inevitable discovery exception to the exclusionary rule. That feels not right. So that feels like when they were going, I think this has come up. It's like, okay, we were going to find this anyway. It was in a place, you know, we would have discovered anyway. Being in a swamp after an intensive search that took several weeks, there's no way it's D. So I think it's solidly between A or C. And I think I'm going to go with what's fair and not with what's likely what the court has done. I think the court has eroded this right that we have, that a criminal defendant has. And so it could be C. It could really be C. But I'm going to go with A on the logic that this is something you have to do because otherwise you're encouraging people to violate, you're encouraging police to violate Miranda rights. If all that happens is, oh, okay, well, all right, we can't bring in this confession, but we found the murder weapon, we got all this other stuff by violating his rights, that would encourage police to behave badly. So I'm going to be very hopeful. I'm going to be an optimist prime and say A, even though it's between A and C, and it might really be C. So A, final answer.
All right, and if you want to play along with Optimist Prime here, you know how to do that. Just share out this episode on social media. Include the hashtag T3BE. Include your guess, your reasons. Therefore, we will pick a winner and shower that winner with never-ending fame and fortune. Fame and fortune not guaranteed.
And that's our show. Thanks so much for listening. And again, Andrew teased a good news show on Tuesday. So looking forward to that myself as well. Can't wait till then. And I'm a patron, so I get it early. All right. Thanks, everybody. We'll see you next time.
I move for a bad court thingy.
You mean a mistrial?
Yeah. That's why you're the judge and I'm the law talking guy.
This has been Opening Arguments with Andrew and Thomas. If you love the show and want to support future episodes, please visit our Patreon page at patreon.com/law. If you can't support us financially, it will be a big help if you leave us a 5-star review on iTunes, Stitcher, or whatever podcast delivery vehicle you use. And be sure to tell all your friends about us. For questions, suggestions, and complaints, email us at openarguments@gmail.com. The show notes and links are on our website at www.openargs.com. Be sure to join the Facebook group at facebook.com/groups/yodelmountain and follow us on Twitter at @openargs. This podcast is a production of Opening Arguments Media, LLC, all rights reserved. It is produced with the assistance of transcriptionist Heather Loveridge, production assistant Ashley Smith, and additional contributions from Morgan Stringer and Deborah Smith. Special thanks to Teresa Gomez, who runs our live shows and heads up the OA Wiki. Follow at OA Wiki on Twitter. Additional thanks to the moderators of the Opening Arguments Facebook community, Emily Waters, Alicia Cook, Eric Brewer, Natalie Newell, Brian Ziegenhagen, and Teresa. And finally, thanks to Thomas Smith, who edits the show and created the fabulous theme music, which was used with permission.